Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 152, The Sponsor Showcase with Louise Marley, and the World Fantasy Convention Extravaganza, including interviews with Patrick Rothfuss, Scott Lynch, Elizabeth Baer, Connie Willis, Robin Sullivan, and many, many more. This episode is brought to you by Hotspur Publishing, the new publisher of science fiction and fantasy literature, and by Picking Up the Ghost, the new novel from Tone Milazzo.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, pods stopped on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing at World Fantasy Convention 2011 with Robert V.S. Reddick. What's up, Robert?
Hey, nice to meet you, Moses.
So we are walking to the tour party right now. It's Friday night, and we're starting to hear the buzz and the commotion, and it's probably going to be deafening pretty soon. But it's great to talk to you, and tell me what you're up to. What's going on at your con experience, and what's next for you?
Well, I'm loving the con. This is my second World Fantasy, and I'm really having the time of my life. I've got people here that are dear friends. I'm meeting lots of new people. I'm meeting heroes, writing heroes that still get me tongue-tied, and all of the expected happy things. And I'm particularly happy this year because my fourth and final book in the series, The Chathrand Voyage, is in. Will be coming out next May, and it's the end of a really long, tough, rewarding road for me, and there's new horizons opening up, so nothing to complain about.
Red Wolf Chronicles?
The Red Wolf Conspiracy was the first one, and, and the quartet is called the Chathrand Voyage Quartet because the ship on which much of these books takes place is called the Chathrand. It's a 600-year-old, preposterously large sailing ship, and that's the setting for these four books.
And how many words is the whole series clocking in at, then?
It's going to be right around 2,200 words. And it's really just one long novel stretched over four books, so 2,200 words. 220,000 words, excuse me.
There we go.
It's late in the evening.
So all four books add up to 220,000. Doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't. Sorry. 2,200. Try pages. Here we go. 2,200 pages.
Okay.
In terms of the average word count is around 200,000 per book.
Okay. Yeah. So something in the neighborhood of 800,000 words.
That's right.
That's a long story.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Right. Even if I can't do the math at this hour. Yeah.
I do that all the time when it comes to page counts and word counts. I always mix those up and...
Yeah, it's long. It's four big bricks, and I never imagined I was getting into anything like this. I had the intention to sit down and write one fairly straightforward story of about, 300 pages, and that was going to be it. It was going to be a standalone. Well, I got myself into all kinds of trouble and went way beyond that.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. So of course, tell us how it ends.
Right. I'm still telling myself that. I have a few more chapters to revise, but... I've still got a few surprises even for myself, but it ends calamitously, totally. The story is complete. You know, I'm not saying everything's tied up with a bow, but you don't wish for a fifth book. You will be very certain you have read to the end of the story, and there are some characters who die, there are massive transitions, there are big ships that go down, there are islands that crumble into the sea, all kinds of things like that.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah, and you said you still have some surprises in store for yourself, even with the ending. Is that right?
Even for myself, I wake up each morning and think, "What about him? What's going to happen to him?" And I think that's how I stay really keyed up all the way to the end. Is that I just I let myself be surprised. I let myself have to work it out and fight it out and wring out those last decisions right to the end. And so far, it hasn't led me to a dead end, so I hope it won't happen this time.
Wow. That's one of the best decisions I made with my book, too, is at the end, I completely changed something about the ending, and now everyone says, oh, I totally did not see that coming. It's because I didn't see it coming.
Right, yeah, and you can sometimes intuit the logic, and you know when you find it that, yes, this is exactly what it needed. But if you just map that out schematically and stuck to it like, you know, building a little model out of Legos, you'd be bored. You'd just be, you know, painting by numbers. It's yeah. when you can excite yourself and totally amaze yourself and surprise yourself, that's when it's fun.
Wow. Well, congratulations for completing a really big series. And do you have any idea what you're going to do after that?
I do. I have a very clear idea. I don't feel too good about talking about it yet, but it's going to be really different. It's going to be simple where the Chatterin voyage was complex. It's going to be character-driven and so on, and it's going to be far away from the ocean. I mean, not say anything more than that.
It's funny because I've seen Steve Erickson, like, after completing, you know, his massive 10-book series, he's going back to, like, these trilogies that are more traditional in scope. And so now that I'm writing something that's turning into a bigger epic, I can see how that happens. You write a big thing, and then you're like, oh, I'm going to write something a little simpler this time. You know?
Be careful. You don't know how long you may be mixed up with this. If you're planning to write a trilogy, you could end up with a trilogy of trilogies. Watch out.
Well, thank you so much for hanging out with us. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing with Nancy Green and Colette Vernon. Let me get you guys to stand closer together. We're here at kind of a release party for your guys' anthology, right?
Right. We're here at the book launch for it.
So that was Nancy. And Colette, say hi.
Hi.
So tell me about what we're launching here.
We're launching an anthology published by Doghorn Press called Woman Writing the Weird.
Okay, now you can only say one sentence at a time, then she has to say something. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
well, damn it. You guys take the lawyer and make her shut up? and it's a collection of women writers that are writing sort of on the edges of known tropes and some things that are just not really classifiable.
So we have science fiction and fantasy and horror and erotica and romance, and it's all on the edge.
And there are boobies on the cover, so
it's big time look and see. Yeah, it's very
Women Writing
right
the Weird, edited by Deb Hoag. Is that how I would say that? How many women are in this anthology?
I would have to sit and count.
One, two, three. I think there's about 30 of us.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And everyone from Hugo nominees to myself, which is the first published for me.
Wow.
And reprints, like
and
me.
And reprints, like Colette.
So is this the first time you guys have been professionally published somewhere?
Well, I was published in an e-magazine, and that was this story that is now in the book.
Okay.
And it's my first publication, so it's very exciting.
Well, congratulations. And full disclosure, we know each other because we met at the first Superstars Writing Seminar. So.
Yes.
Yeah. Are either of you guys going to Vegas?
Absolutely.
Hoping.
Okay. I'll be there, I think. Yeah. So that's at the end of April, beginning of May. It's like one of those crossover month things. So how's the con going for you guys?
Really well. It's been kind of fun. It's also my first con, so that's been kind of neat.
Nice.
It's fabulous. Knowing people, this is the second time I've gone to the World Fantasy, and knowing people and getting around, and this is fabulous. Wow. So much fun.
How long have you guys had the actual book to hold and look at and gawk over?
Yesterday. I had to knock on the shipping person's door and get my book. And it's not out yet on Amazon, so one of the nice things about it is we're doing it early.
So, and thank goodness Nancy got hers because I haven't received mine yet.
So how's it feel seeing your name on the cover there?
That's fabulous. It's great.
Yeah,
nothing better.
There's nothing better, and it's really hard to explain. It's all like chills and chivalry.
Nice. So what kind of stuff are you guys working on now? What do you think is next for you?
I have a science fiction novel that I'm trying to sell and an urban fantasy that's going and about 6 short stories out. We'll see what happens.
I've got a fantasy that I'm trying to sell, and I'm writing a urban fantasy / cyberpunk.
Fun.
Yeah.
All right, well, that was Nancy Green and Colette M. Vernon, and hope to hear big things from you guys in the future.
Thanks, Moses.
This is Moses Sirigar at World Fantasy Convention with Lori Tom. How you doing, Lori?
Pretty good, thank you.
So we met at the Superstars Writing Seminar earlier this year, the second one, and you were there partly because you won Writers of the Future, right?
Yes, I did.
That was, is it the 2010?
Yeah, I got the 2010. I won the grand prize.
Wow, excellent, excellent. And we were just talking about how you write by hand, so talk about that.
Well, I used to write on the computer, and I found that I would get stopped. I would look at the blank page and be like, well, what do I need to do? And I find when I write by hand, my mental process is slower. So it kind of puts my mental process and the actual writing speed in sync with each other, and I get more down. And I feel less constrained about editing because it's very difficult to edit by hand, sort of crossing things out and writing things in the margins. And whereas if you're on the computer, you're like, well, that didn't sound right. I'll just back up a few words. I'll type some new ones out.
Wow. Have you been to a lot of cons like this?
World Fantasy is my first major con. There's a local con where I live, LostCon, that I go to, but it's nothing on this scale. It's very small.
And is this year the first year you've been to World Fantasy?
Yes, it's my first year.
Okay. So how's it going? What do you think?
It's pretty good. I've got to meet a lot of people, and it's nice because there's a certain energy when you're with a lot of other writers.
Yeah, yeah. So what are you working on these days? What's next for you?
There is a fantasy novel that I'm currently outlining, and I hope to start the actual writing on it in about a week.
Yeah. Is fantasy or sci-fi your first love?
I would have to say fantasy. I do write some science fiction, but it always comes down to fantasy. I like going on adventures. I like going to different worlds. I like magic.
That's cool. I haven't read your story yet from Writers of the Future. So what was that story like?
That story is Living Rooms. It's about the daughter of a magician who comes home to find out her father has passed away and left her a magical house. But there is a rival magician that wants to take it over. So she has to come to master the house so that way she can reclaim her inheritance.
Oh, okay. Do you have any advice for people who are entering Writers of the Future trying to be grand finalists?
I would say you have to tell a good story with a lot of heart and make sure that you nail the ending. Because a lot of stories end up being honorable mentions or semi-finalists or finalists. And from what I've heard, what it comes down to is the end.
Interesting. Great. How long was yours, by the way?
Mine was about 15,000 words, so it was pretty long.
Okay. I've heard the longer ones tend to do better. Do you think that's right?
I think I was actually longer than average, but I've heard that generally longer stories are better. 2,000 words is a little rough, but once you get more like 7 or 8, then it's more common.
Okay. Are you planning on going to any other cons or workshops or seminars or anything like that in the coming year?
I plan on going to LostCon this coming Thanksgiving, and with luck, I'll also be at WorldCon next year.
Okay, nice. Well, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing at the World Fantasy Convention 2011, and I'm sitting here with Patrick Karafas. Pat is sipping. Is that Starbucks I see in your hand there?
Yeah, I'm not proud of it, but it's the only game in town here.
You get your cheap sunglasses on. You kind of got the ZZ Top look going on right now.
Yeah. Well, it's not bright and sunny in Wisconsin right now, and my body really hasn't had a chance to adjust yet. It's gorgeous. It's every day the weather here is just an absolute carbon copy of the day before. It's 70 degrees and sunny and breezy and cool, and it's starting to get to me, in all honesty.
Do you ever see yourself leaving Wisconsin for sunnier pastures then?
No, there's no sense in that. Everyone always, once the book started to do well, they're like, oh, when are you moving to New York? I'm like, good Lord, why would I want to, pay that much to live somewhere where, everybody hates you? That's not true. I've been to New York and the people are actually very nice, but I'm of the firm belief you get too many people together in one place and they go crazy like rats in a coffee can.
So we're on, this is Sunday, the con is almost over. We're going to have the banquet and then the World Fantasy Awards coming up soon. Are you nominated for anything this year, by the way?
Oh, no.
No, okay. Not eligible this year sort of thing?
Not eligible, not qualified, none of it. I'm shooting, the only thing I'm qualified here is least best dressed. We got people here wearing tuxes and ties and ball gowns and fancy tiaras. No, I only have one mode of dress. Well, two if you count naked. But I don't own anything other than T-shirts.
Today it's the Powell's Books T-shirt.
Yes.
I was just admiring. You had kind of a Cthulhu and a Celtic knot the other day. Some other people were admiring that one, I saw.
Yeah. Well, this is a fairly safe place to wear your geek T-shirts, and luckily for me, I have nothing but.
Yeah, we saw you at the signing the other day, and you and Neil Gaiman were kind of in a similar area there, and it was cool to see, you know, you guys hanging out. Have you got to talk to Neil at all here?
You know, I kind of glanced him once or twice, but aside from being the rock star, he's the, you know, one of the main attractions here, so he's been busy, and
yeah.
Panels and readings and signings and just kind of one thing after another, so I've gotten to say hello, but that's about it.
Yeah. Are you doing the banquet and the award ceremony?
Or? Yeah, that's where I'm planning on being least best dressed. everyone is really seriously duded up here. I'm glad I didn't know about it beforehand, or I would have felt guilty about not bringing anything fancy to wear.
So how are you surviving now that we're at the end of the con? Did you get enough sleep? Did you eat well? How'd that go?
Oh, you know, this is a fairly relaxed con for me. There's so many authors here that you're lucky if you get a panel. And I had my one panel, and that was about it. The rest of the time was just kind of hanging out and talking to folks.
I saw someone retweeted something that you said on that panel. It was something like the difference between a romantic poet and a crazy stalker is how you feel about them.
Yeah, pretty much. That shouldn't be news to anybody who's ever unsuccessfully pursued someone.
Well, I should ask this for your fans. How's it going with book three? Where's that at?
It's awful. I haven't even started it. I decided to not write book three at all.
And that's it. So maybe we'll have better news for you next year or something like that.
I don't know. Everybody, you know, and I realize it's just the kind of curiosity, and I feel the same way a lot about a lot of other authors. But there's just so many times you can answer that question. And not want to. I've decided to come up with a new answer every time.
Perfectly understandable. And it'll be there when it's there. So anyway, man, we appreciate you talking to us earlier this year as well. And we'll see what happens at the awards here. Hopefully no fights break out. But
yeah, well, I'm rooting for, my longtime author friend and part of the Daw family, Nnedi Okorafor is up for like the big win. And so I'm kind of rooting for her. I'm curious to see how it settles out.
Awesome. All right, man. Chat with you later.
This is Moses with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, World Fantasy Convention 2011, here with Robin Sullivan, who we've had on the podcast before. How's it going, Robin?
Very well, thank you.
So we're at the end of the con now. It's Sunday. It's like sunset right now. We were just talking with K.W. Jeter, who founded the term steampunk, and he estimated like 1982 was approximately when that was. So we're at the end of it, and everyone's like out of here now, but we're still hanging out and talking. So tell me about what your con was like for you.
Well, this was the first time I was at this convention, and I had a real good time, met a lot of really interesting people. It's been very interesting to see how some of the changes in the industry are coming about, and sometimes I get involved with people who have been involved with traditional publishing for a long time, and they seem very rooted in that. And I'm seeing now more and more people are opening their minds to other alternatives, and that's real nice to see.
Yeah, I met with two agents and one editor here that I'm like interested in. I showed all of them my book. I showed them my Amazon page, and I said, you know, does this scare you off? And they all said no with no hesitation.
Oh, good.
So that was interesting. So for those who don't know Robin, you're the head of Ryden Publishing, right?
I am.
Yep. And so you're releasing, you do most of your business in ebooks, but you produce some nice books as well, and you're considered, you know, one of the experts on ebook promotion and marketing and sales these days. So what did you see? Anything interesting here? Any, you know, cool panels? Did you meet any people that really made a big impression on you?
Yeah, I had quite a few panels that I really liked. Really what I was doing here was, as I'm sure many publishers are, I'm kind of scoping out the waters. And I've contacted a number of people that I was really surprised that are very interested in possibly publishing with my company. I obviously can't say anything until we get them signed, but really exciting times are going on, and I'm very, very encouraged by that. So it's just been a wonderful it's been a wonderful adventure from that standpoint. My husband, who's being published through Orbit, his editor was here, and some of the people from his publisher, and it's always good to hang out with those people. So I got to spend some time in both areas, both the traditional publishing and then some of the new ways of publishing.
Wow. And are you, it seems like you're moving more towards acquiring some big name authors, people who have been traditionally published and have a big name and so forth. Is that correct to say about Ryden right now?
So there's a couple things. Traditionally, it's really interesting because traditionally our authors have been really unknowns. They're just, you know, Joes in the trenches working really hard, and we've been very, very successful at doing that. But I've actually had agents and authors contacting me directly about that, and so I think it's very good for the for all my authors, because in this business, you know, the tide rises all boats. So I recently announced on my website that I signed A.C. Crispin, and so we have her Starbridge books coming out, and she's our first New York Times bestselling author, and that will be a big help. So as far as writing is concerned, we're interested in all authors. The important thing is good stories that we really enjoy. But by getting some of the bigger names in at a very small press, I think it's going to help even our little publisher, our little authors who are just really kind of starting off in the business.
Yep. And are those mainly the folks you're targeting right now, the people you're bringing in and releasing, like new authors that you'll be, you know, promoting in the future? Is that... That's the current focus, right?
Actually, I have no current focus at the moment. I have a backlog, so I am officially closed to submissions. So, and I should be coming off of that shortly. I've got four books that I need to get out, and I'm trying to get all those out by Christmas, in which case I will be off of that. But when certain opportunities arise that you can't really pass up, it's worth having conversations with people. So yes, you know, I recently put out, for instance, Joe Haldeman's Forever War. Mm-hmm. And that was not something I had on my horizon. It wasn't something I was going off to. But when that opportunity presents itself, you kind of make exceptions for that. So I have made some exceptions for some aspects, but I'm not really targeting anyone in particular.
Right. Okay, cool. Well, it was great to talk to you. I'll see you next time.
Okay, thank you.
You won. This is Moses Irigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, and with Scott Lynch and Elizabeth Baer. Yeah. So, what's up, guys?
We have just survived another World Fantasy Convention.
Stole the words right out of my brain.
Nobody died.
That we know of. Nobody important, anyway.
No wine bottles were shattered during the awards ceremony.
Nobody that David Hartwell can't sink into the foundation of one of the buildings around here.
There's a crypt underneath the Flatiron. Oh, I went.
Changing subject. came from the awards ceremony.
You might want to seize control of this interview now.
We just came from the awards ceremony where Elizabeth was nominated. Mm-hmm. And what happened with that pregnant pause?
Oh, pardon me, my tongue.
Another Elizabeth with a monosyllabic last name was nominated as well, so there was some suspense when the announcer said, and the winner is Elizabeth. You know, audible ellipses for several seconds, hand, rather than bear.
Which, there's absolutely no shame in getting your ass kicked
by Elizabeth
Hand. We love
you too, Elizabeth Hand.
And describe what happened to your heart as she was saying, Elizabeth
Fortunately, I was sitting next to one of my editors who very calmly reached over and placed her hand on my shoulders so that my heart did not actually leap out my back.
That was a Vulcan nerve pinch.
Oh, well, it is Beth Meacham, who, as we all know, has superpowers. So...
Wow, so this is the first time you guys have actually been interviewed together, you were
yes.
saying.
Yes,
yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah. I don't know, is there... God. You should say something else erudite and clever now.
That's what I'm here for. I get tall things, I go to shows, I carry things, I give back rub, I say erudite things.
I know my role in this relationship. I got it down pat.
I keep him around for his wit and intelligence.
I fetch and carry...
Wow, this is one of the cutest things I've seen at the con.
Aren't we just goddamn disgusting?
We are disgusting. I've actually seen people whipping out insulin syringes. So.
Like Amanda Downham at this very moment. She doesn't know why, but she's experiencing, you know, she's dizzy and she's having trouble standing up and she's going, why? Why?
So, well, we need gossip on your relationship, so go right to the source.
I don't know if there's anything really to gossip about. We've been friends for a long time, and about 4 months ago sort of had an epiphany, and then we spent about a month trying to argue each other out of it and failed. Is that pretty much covered?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
You've got like a meat cute version that's...
No. I won't bore the readers with the readers. Listeners. Hi, readers. How's it going? I bet you're as confused as I am right now. We retired to the bar to do the traditional, hey, let's have a drink and share our horrible divorce stories. And, one drink turns into two, turns into four, turns into, you know, 5 hours, turns into, hey, it's 5 a.m, where are we sleeping tonight? Who knows? Bob's your uncle, Sue's your aunt, hey, as one does.
What shade of red am I right now?
Redder than your dress.
Okay.
You know, we decided that it was definitely time for, some financial and emotional stability in our lives. So clearly dating another author was the way to achieve that.
What I really wanted was somebody with a steady job and health insurance. So
most definitely. Yeah, I had the book Marry Your Way to Riches, and I've only gotten to the first chapter or two, but I'm sure authors are in there somewhere. Maybe it's at the back. She's a lovely woman, honest.
I didn't even have a gun to his ribs when he said that.
That's true.
Ow.
That's true. See, they really are this cute. This is just how it is. It's nice.
It's sickening. We can admit that. It's been a pretty good convention, despite the fact that this this compound that we're in is sort of a non-Euclidean Disneyland, and finding anybody is a challenge in and of itself.
I'm reasonably certain that they used this place as the location for several mythical Eastern European countries in the 1960s Mission Impossible television show. It's even got the little Checkpoint Charlie gates. And the people in the beige uniforms.
Yeah, the Ruritania WFC has been really fun, guys.
All right, well, thank you so much for chatting with us, you guys.
Thank you for chatting with us.
Our pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by Hotspur Publishing, a new publisher of science fiction and fantasy literature founded by New York Times bestselling author David Bischoff. They released their first book at the Twilight's Last Gleaming just this September, which takes readers to a 1968 high school production of Dracula, which happens to feature vampires and werewolves that are all too real. Other new titles include Saul Grinnell's Freedom Club, a tale set in a future overrun by consumerism, technology, and discontent, where being human isn't good enough and godlike sentient beings threaten all. And of course, there is The Destiny Dice, a yarn where demons, dragons, talking cats, and magic are the least of the perils a hero must brave on a misguided quest to save a beautiful runaway princess, praised by Piers Anthony as hilarious. Founder David Bischoff will be publishing a number of his out-of-print titles through Hotspur, as well as soliciting work from new authors. David has over 80 books published, including novels set in the worlds of Star Trek The Next Generation, Farscape, and Alien vs. Predator. He has also penned two scripts for Star Trek The Next Generation, Tin Man and First Contact. Additionally, David has years of editing experience on the editorial staffs of Amazing Stories, Fantastic, and Quantum SF in Review. To learn more and to explore Hotspur's new lineup of science fiction and fantasy, visit our website and click on the image for Hotspur Publishing, or go to hotspurpublishing.wordpress.com. Hotspur Publishing, new science, new magic, new books. Check it out. Louise Marley is the author of Mozart's Blood, The Child Goddess, The Horse Mistress Saga, and, of course, The Brahms Deception, which we have had sponsoring the podcast for a little bit now, and we're very pleased to have the novel bringing the show to you. And she is joining me now from her home, in Seattle, I believe, right?
Well, I'm east of Seattle, yes, Redmond. Hi.
East of Seattle, okay, great. So thank you for coming on the show. Welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Okay, so let's talk about the Brahms Deception a little bit. It is a time travel story and a love story that takes readers deep into the life of Johannes Brahms. And, you know, I noticed this is not, certainly, this is not your first novel that is inspired by music or that music plays some really important role in the book. So could you start us off by telling us a little bit about your musical background and how that background informs your work?
I was a singer in my first career for a long time. I sang opera and I sang concert repertoire. And so, I mean, I've been steeped in classical music since I was in high school. So naturally, I'm interested in some of the composers more than others and in music in general. In my first trilogy, which is in an omnibus edition now called The Singers of Nevia, it was all about what it is to be a singer and the power of music. And then another novel of mine was The Glass Harmonica, which featured Mozart, who then cropped up later again in Mozart's Blood. But as a singer and as a singer of concert repertoire, Brahms was always one of my favorite composers, both to listen to and to sing. It was really fun to kind of explore the possibilities in his life and the life of Clara Schumann, who was his great friend, and about whom there has been a lot of speculation. Hmm.
Do you still do anything in music now?
I do occasionally. Mostly now I write full-time, so I found that as time went on, it was hard to keep both careers going, and naturally a singing career is limited just by time, sadly.
Right.
But and writing is not, so the nice thing for me is that I have this other lovely thing to do, and I get to explore music almost as much as I did when I was singing.
You mentioned that Brahms is one of your favorite composers, one of your favorite musicians, and the story that you delve into here is one of mystery and one that people have talked about. So can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about that and the history behind it and why not just you, but so many people are fascinated by it?
Yes, it really was an interesting phenomenon of the relationship between Clara Schumann, who is the widow of Robert Schumann, another great composer, and Johannes Brahms. Because and it helps to understand the context of the 19th century that they were living in. Clara Schumann was a fabulous pianist and a famous musician in her own right. And she, because her husband died so young in an insane asylum, she had 8 children to support on her own as a concert artist, which could not have been easy. Anything that affected her reputation would limit her audiences. And so her relationship with Brahms had to be completely innocent, completely without any taint of scandal. And many people have guessed or supposed that there was something deeper between them, but there's absolutely no evidence historically to show it. However, you know, when you think about these two amazing people, it's natural to think that there might have been a romance between them. There's no evidence except that what I did was find historically a little gap in both of their life histories where perhaps they were together. So that's the idea that I played off of for The Brahms Deception. And of course, it's a time travel novel. So what happens is that the people who are traveling through time to research Brahms sort of accidentally happen upon his little idyll, his little escape with Clara Schumann.
Now, if I remember correctly, doesn't the protagonist, she jumps into the body of Schumann, right?
Into Clara Schumann's body, yes.
Yes.
This is not supposed to happen with these time travelers. They're supposed to be only observers, but that character, who is the antagonist, actually, finds a way to stay in the 19th century because she has been obsessed with Brahms, who was dead before she was born, but she's been obsessed with him since she was a very young girl. And so when she goes back and finds that Clara Schumann is there, she views that as an opportunity, and mayhem ensues.
There are a number of genres I see blending together here, and we're talking about the science fiction element, so why don't we delve into that a little bit. How deeply do you go into the science of time travel, and how important is that to the story, other than the fact, of course, that it gets the characters there?
Well, it is the device through which to tell the story, and I'm not going to go deeply into the science of time travel because, for one thing, we don't have it. I think probably Connie Willis's model is the one that I follow the most closely, which is that you know the science is there, but you don't know anything about it.
Right.
And that's because there really isn't any such. I mean, I subscribe to the Einsteinian approach where all times exist at all times, and if you can place yourself with the right coordinates mentally and physically, then you can actually bridge the gaps between time, but not interfere with time. That's the whole idea, and it's the principle behind, the sort of pseudoscience that I use in the books. But in fact, it's a device in order to allow people to go back, kind of as Connie Willis did with her Doomsday book or with her most recent World War II novels. It's a device to place the characters in this other time. And, of course, to raise the problem of the paradox, which is one of the things my characters have to deal with, which is if you change time, then what happens?
Right, the butterfly effect.
Well, yes, it's the butterfly effect. In this case, it's a song that disappears that Clara Schumann wrote, which is kind of a very small butterfly, but that's what happens.
Very cool. Now, do you see this as a standalone novel, or do you see it as something with serious potential as we follow the time travelers who are studying these musicians at the past?
Well, I could certainly see using the device again, but in this case, in this story, it's a standalone novel. And really, the novel for me is as much about Clara Schumann as it is about Brahms, a way to look at what life was like for women in the 19th century and what the challenges were, and the contrast between my female character of the, you know, sort of near future 21st century and the realities of life as a woman of the 19th century. So in my mind, this story is complete, especially because we, you know, look at their lives until a great age. I don't see it as a series other than the fact that I'm doing three novels with composers at their center.
Right.
Brahms, and then the next one is Puccini.
Okay, and when's that one coming out?
That one will be out in September of 2012.
Okay, great.
And it's going to be called The Glass Butterfly.
It was kind of reminded me, I don't know if you're familiar with author, is it Susan Vreeland or Vreeland or something like that?
Oh, yes, Susan Vreeland, uh-huh.
Yeah, and you know, she writes novels that are centered around art pieces, and she kind of tells the story around a particular famous piece of art. And I was thinking, oh, this is kind of like a cooler, a speculative take on that concept with the musicians, but of course it's better because there's time travel in this one and vampires and Mozart's blood, so it's definitely much cooler.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to, I know it's a little hard to classify because they're not strictly historical since there are these speculative elements and since I'm essentially a fantasy and science fiction writer. So, but there are other authors who have delved into these realms. It's true. And who's the other one? There's a wonderful one who wrote a book Stephanie Cowell, who wrote Marrying Mozart, and she's recently written a book about Monet. I'm a very good writer, but they're strictly historical, so they don't have this speculative element.
Right. You mentioned Connie Willis. Are you a fan of time travel novels in particular?
I'm a fan of Connie Willis, I must say. I think I've read everything she's written, and I do love her time travel novels. I think To Say Nothing of the Dog may be one of the most perfect novels I've ever read because it works as historical fiction, and it works as comedy, and it works as science fiction, so it's really a terrific piece. Yeah, I'm definitely a Connie Willis acolyte.
The Brahms Deception and Mozart's Blood, do they appeal to the same audience? And I ask this because I know there are vampires in Mozart's Blood, but I don't know how deeply you go into sort of vampiric lore and gore, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I do know what you mean. One of the things that I was greatly relieved about with Mozart's Blood is that the vampire readers were not disappointed because I knew it would be something different. But one of the nice things about the vampire literature is that the readers are open to different takes on it. I mean, we have to face it, it's speculative. There aren't, as far as we know, there aren't really vampires. So, again, it's a device which gives you a chance to tell a story, and I wanted to tell a story about an opera singer who has multiple careers. The career of an opera singer is very short. Mm-hmm. It's limited by mostly by age. And so, and it seemed to me, as having been one of those opera singers, that it would be great if you could have two or three or more careers so that you could build on what you had learned in each one. And so the vampire traditions were a great way to be able to tell that story. And it was really fun. And fortunately, people seemed to have really enjoyed that and not worried about the fact that, like, my vampires don't sparkle, my vampires can go out in the sunlight. They're all different, you know, because anybody can create really their own vampire traditions. I'm really good friends with Barb and J.C. Hendy, who write a long vampire series, and their vampire traditions are quite different from mine, and yet the readers of their series and the readers of my book really don't have a problem, don't seem to have a problem accepting the differences.
I don't read a lot of vampires, but it seems like most of them are either sort of like, there's this bit, of course, right now with Twilight and everything, there's lots of teeny angst kind of vampires, and then there's the more kind of really horrific vampires. And for me, even
the way they started out.
Right, right. And some of it just for me as my sensibilities, I guess, I just can't take it all. It's too much for me, all the blood and everything. I guess I don't have the stomach for it.
Well, that's why my opera singer vampire found a, well, she her sidekick, I guess, found a way around it. One of the best vampire novels I've ever read was George R. R. Martin. Oh. His book, it's called Fever Dream, and it's fabulous. And it was a book that I read quite some time ago, and it gave me courage to take a different approach to vampires. Mm. Because it's a historical piece set on a riverboat on the Mississippi River. A wonderful book. And it's not long like his current series that go on and on and on. And I just thought it was wonderful. So it tells us that we can play with these tropes without being limited by them, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So you mentioned the third book, and I want to go ahead and find out a little bit of what that's going to be about. And I have to admit, I'm going to ask this. Is it about time traveling vampires? Because I think that would be pretty cool.
No.
Okay.
Time traveling vampires. Now, there's an idea. No, it's quite different. The Glass Butterfly is a story that takes place mostly in the current day, with flashes of memory of a time when Puccini was living in one of the towns where he had a home in Italy, Torre del Lago. And it's about a young girl that worked for his family and what happened to her and how it connects to the life of a woman in the current day who vanishes herself, who has a reason that she has to disappear and create an entirely new life on the Oregon coast, and how that memories of the past cause her to come to have to deal with or decide that she'd better deal with the conflict that she's facing in her life. So it's a little less musical, a little more contemporary, and although Puccini figures in it, again, I tend to do this, again, it tends to be more about the women in his life than about Puccini himself.
Now, if you don't mind, if I ask you a question about a different series you wrote a couple years back, would that be all right?
Sure. Oh, sure.
Okay, great. So the Horse Mistress Saga you wrote, and that was published under a different name at the time, and I noticed now it's on your website. I was very fortunate to be able to make a promo for you, which my wife helped me with, and I thought that turned out really well. It's still one of my favorite ones we did. But I was wondering, though, why was that published under a different name when you had already had novels come out under your name at that time?
Right. It's when you choose to write under a pseudonym, there are a couple different reasons. Sometimes it's just a market thing. Sometimes it's a signal to readers and to book buyers that that you're going in a different direction, which in this case it was. The target audience was young adult, although obviously there were lots of adult readers. So it was just, it was so much different. In the past, I'd written science fantasy, and then I wrote several science fiction novels. And then this was a pure fantasy series. And so it seemed, Ace felt at the time that it was better to do it under a pseudonym. So I used my mother's maiden name. And wrote about something I love, which is horses, and which I'm going back to in a couple of books to write something else about horses. So that's why. The whole thing about pseudonyms is it tends to be an open secret. So it was never a big secret that Toby Bishop was also Louise Marani. I mean, if you know some writers like, well, P.D. James, for example, writes under two or three different names, or Chris Rush writes under several names, it's not uncommon. But there are all kinds of different reasons to do it.
Well, Louise, is there anything else about the Brahms Deception that you would like us to know that I didn't ask?
Well, the only thing is that I'd love to have any readers who are interested come and visit my website, because I have links to a couple of pieces of music that I think are really fun to listen to. They're short. It's not a big deal. It's not necessary to really be a lover of classical music to enjoy the novel, I don't think. I don't think that music is that essential to the story, but it makes a nice background, gives kind of an ambiance to appreciate these characters.
Yeah, you have some really cool stuff on your website. There was another one of your novels where you had a, you know, if you're looking to buy a house, they do the virtual tours, you know, and you have one of those where you show the locations that are in the book, and I've never seen anyone do that before, so you have some really cool things
that was
on there.
Different, wasn't it? Well, that was for Mozart's Blood. Everyone was doing book trailers, and I didn't think a book trailer was going to represent the book very well, so I thought a virtual tour would be a lot of fun because it covers a lot of geography and 400 years. So, that was really great fun to do.
Yeah,
and the music is gorgeous. So.
Yeah, no, it was unique and got my attention, so that's what it's supposed
to
be.
Well, anybody can come to louisemarley.com and you can find all this, and also some sort of background information, a little bit of bibliography for anyone who's really into the history. You don't have to be, but if anyone's really into knowing where the history comes from, it's all there.
And, of course, you can come to our website and click on the image for the Brahms Deception right there on the homepage. That will open up the Amazon page for the bookstore, or check out your the Amazon page for the book, or go to your local bookstore to pick up your copy today. LouiseMarley.com is the website, and you can see all these things we're talking about and much more. It's a great website. Louise, thank you for sponsoring the podcast. We really appreciate your support, and thank you for joining us today in the showcase.
Sure, it was great, Sean. Thanks.
Sink Williams is in a haunted store about to make a very bad deal with a lunatic magician and a Loa that wants to be a god. If he knew any better, he'd walk away right now. But Sink never knows better. He opened the wrong letter. That cost him his heart. Then he hitched the wrong ride to Chicago. That cost him his fate. And once this deal is done, he's going to make his worst mistake yet. He's going to trust his father's ghost. And then he'll lose everything. I could have warned him, sure, but I'm not here to help Sink. I'm here to watch him die.
Picking Up the Ghost by Tone Milazzo and Cheezine Publications. Available in paper and electronic, wherever you buy books, online or in the real world.
Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, and I'm here with Connie Willis at the World Fantasy Convention 2011 in San Diego. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. We're glad to have you on our show just a little while ago.
Uh-huh.
You did a great interview with Brent. So how's it going? What are you doing at the conference?
Thanks. Well, I got to have a conversation with Neil Gaiman. I don't just mean we sat down and talked over coffee. We sat down and talked over coffee in front of 500 people.
Right, right.
And they didn't give us any coffee. So, but it was very fun, and we managed to I think, amuse and entertain people, I hope. And actually, the cool thing was we got to talk about some stuff that we usually don't get to talk about writing and the process and what it means to us and books we like and the kinds of questions we wish people would ask us and all that sort of thing. So it was lots of fun.
I was interviewing someone when you guys were doing that. I hope someone recorded it.
Yeah, it was very fun. So
yeah,
and there were no fisticuffs. That was, you know,
right.
I guess that's a minus. I mean, people really like fisticuffs, but
yeah, normally you would just kind of lay into.
Normally, I would just pound him into the ground. But but in this particular case, we felt we should try and talk civilly. So.
Wow, interesting. It's like the San Diego vibe.
That's
or something,
it. That's
know?
It. It's just so mellow here. There's all these palm trees and there's swimming pools. I think this place has three or four swimming pools and hot tubs and lots of shade. It's just beautiful.
Excellent. Well, what can people look forward to next from you?
The new book I'm working on is my UFO novel, and it's called The Road to Roswell, and it's a romantic comedy.
Oh, wow.
There are very few alien abduction romantic comedy novels, but, you know, I thought I'd write one.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks for chatting with us.
Thank you.
Eric James Stone. How's it going, Eric?
Very well, thanks.
Any big news for you? You won the Nebula Award earlier this year for best
novelette. One of my novelettes that was published in Analog. It's a great thrill. Just to have been nominated was a great thrill, and to win was just great.
How does it feel now to be a Nebula Award winner?
In some ways, it's put a little pressure on me. I have kind of feel the pressure to write stuff that proves I was actually worthy of such an award.
Ah, that makes sense. Because now you have to sort of show that the award means something, right? Because you're kind of carrying that torch, and so you have a certain standard you have to keep yourself to now.
Exactly. I greatly respect the members of CIFWA, and so I want to, go on to show that I have a good career ahead of me, and that, their faith in me and my story wasn't misplaced.
So what's new with you? Anything going on?
Well, I'm working on revising a novel right now for an editor who's potentially interested in it, and I've got some short stories that are coming out in analog and daily science fiction.
Beautiful. So what are you doing at the con here? This is just sort of like day two, I guess. We're like in the afternoon of day two, so we still have a while to go. What do you think you'll be up to here?
Well, I've been going to a lot of readings, mostly by friends, because I want to hear their stuff. And
yeah.
I will be going to the mass signing tonight, of course. And then I've been meeting with my agent and with some editors and things like that.
Okay, great. So what can we look forward to next from you?
Well, I should have a short story coming out in analog at the beginning of the year. And it's one I really enjoyed writing, and so I hope people enjoy reading it.
Oh, great. What's it called? Do you know?
It's called Lobstersaurus. It's about a girl and her pet gigantic lobster.
That sounds fantastic. All right, man. Well, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing at World Fantasy Convention 2011. And I'm here with Jonathan Wood. I know your name. Because I interviewed you earlier this year. We talked about Jonathan's new book coming out, which, as you will remember, answers the existential question, what would Kurt Russell do?
What would he do?
Yes. And so now your book is out. Last time we talked, it was not out. So
yes.
Talk about what's been going on in your world.
So it came out beginning of July. Been working a lot on the sequel. It was a two-book deal, so just getting to wrap that up. And so that's been... It's been fun trying to do that. This is the first time I've had the deadline to meet and really trying to crank it out in a year. So yes, I'm feeling a little odd. The deadline has come out. I started last November and probably got a couple more weeks and that'll be wrapped up.
Okay. And tell us the name of the two books.
So No Hero came out this year, and Yesterday's Hero is out, I think, next July or August. And it's all the same characters from the first book, introduced some new stuff, but it'll be a standalone to a certain extent. People won't need to have read No Hero to get it, but it's just fun sort of messing around with. Arthur's is just a fun character to play with. Yeah, he's my protagonist, and he is frequently overwhelmed by what he's up against. So it's always fun to just write his bewilderment at the horrors he faces. So.
Nice. This is with Nightshade Books, right?
Yes. No. They were kind enough to publish me. So
Nightshade had a little party last night that we were
with
at
a Razorhead Press. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was.
It was cool. It was like that was kind of like the darker, shadier sort of party. You know, you had Tor downstairs.
Yeah, the big flash party going on.
Right.
But yeah,
you went to Nightshade, and it was more like a little. It was edgier, you know.
Yeah. No. It's a good crowd. They got some cool authors. I got to chat with some of the other people. They're doing this big New Voices program. They put up, I think they're saying 15 debut authors, I think, this year.
Oh, wow.
So, and they're really trying to build up a stable of new authors and new voices. And so it was cool to get to meet some of those guys. John Horner Jacobs had a book out this year. What's it called? I blanked on the name now, but we were part of Southern Gods, which has been getting ridiculously good reviews. And he and I, along with my editor Ross Lockhart, put out a book, this big Cthulhu anthology of recent Cthulhu fiction. And so they did this big summer of Cthulhu promotion that we're part of. And it was nice to meet him and Bradley Bollier, who had Winds of Calicovo, Stina Lecht. Who else was there that I got to hang out with? Robert Ziegler, I think. His book Seed is coming out soon, and he has got the most ridiculously gorgeous cover I've ever seen.
Seed,
yes. Okay. Yeah, no, they're giving away packets of pumpkin seed in the dealer's room as a promo card. So, but no, it was just nice to meet all the people they're pushing forward, and they're doing some good work, so it's cool.
Yeah, it was a nice energy in there. I had fun hanging out with those guys. So, are you working on anything new? Do you know what's going to be next for you?
Next, I'm not sure. That's probably why I'm here this weekend trying to work out. Yeah, like I say, in a couple of weeks I'll have to work out decide what to do next. So it'll be there's two basic things that I just need to pick between. So we'll see.
Okay.
So my agent is here as well, so I'm talking with him.
Nice. Have you gotten any fun feedback on your book? Any nice quotes or anything like that, or like?
I very much like the guy who said make this a movie. Whoever that guy is, I totally agree with him. If anyone with that power is listening. no, the reviews is I've been lucky that it's been generally positive. Publishers Weekly were nice to me, and that was a good day.
Oh wow! So that must have been a big relief.
Yeah. No, I was. Yeah, that's the one you sort of wait for. You know?
Yeah.
So that was cool to get. Yeah. To get the tip of the hat from them. And then it was funny. Locus reviewed it, and that's the one copy I cannot find in New York City for some reason. It was in their August issue, and so but they'd had a preview of the magazine online, and so the first two paragraphs of the review were online, and that was just introducing it, and there was no the opinion part. I just got, and then so today, yesterday, I finally got to read the actual review.
Really?
So it was a little like, hello, I'm at your table. I'm just gonna leaf through this. If I start to cry, don't mind me. No, they were nice about it too. So that was cool.
Oh, great.
No,
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, okay. Obviously, not everybody is going to love every book, but yeah, no, so far it's been pretty nice.
Great. Well, it's great to chat with you, man. We'll talk to you later.
No, good to see you.
I'm here with K.W. Jeter. I got to film the panel you were on earlier called Founders of Steampunk,
mm-hmm.
and you're one of your many claims to fame is that you coined the term steampunk, right?
That's correct. I mean, it's a slim claim to fame, but I'll take it as long as it doesn't show up on my tombstone. But yes, I wrote a letter to Locus magazine many, many years ago where I was sort of joking around and coined the word steampunk as a joke. And over the years, somehow, it just sort of became a convenient label for a whole creative movement and literary movement and people having fun sort of thing. And like I said, it just became a convenient label to put on what people were already doing.
Because, you were also writing, you were one of the early folks writing the stories that were steampunk, right?
There were people before us who were doing pretty much the same sort of thing. Harry Harrison did some things, and Michael Moorcock, the sort of pastiche of Victorian fiction. I think Jim Blaylock and I especially did some things that were very sort of Victorian, and Tim Powers did some things pretty similar. And it just happened right at the time when, everything was being called something punk. You had cyberpunk and splatterpunk and this punk and that punk and the other punk. So that was kind of the joke, more on that notion of something punk than anything else.
You were trying to punk the punks.
Yeah, we were trying to punk the punks. Though one of the things I'm actually happy about is that when you look at what steampunk became over the years, of all those something punk, pseudo-movements, it was one of the more genuine ones, and it was one of the ones that was actually most punk-like. That it has a certain energy to it and a certain anarchic flavor to it, where people are taking history and just ripping it to shreds and doing whatever the hell they want to it with it, and they don't care whether it's historically accurate or not. And so, in that sense, it's like those crazy punk rock groups who didn't care whether they could play their instruments or not; they were going to do something. And so, in that sense, the whole DIY nature that was sort of inherent to the original punk rock music kind of really plugs into what a lot of people do with steampunk, and that's kind of that makes it fun.
That's a good point. So, what year was it that you wrote that letter?
Oh my God, was it 1982, somewhere around there. If the official historian of steampunk was here, which is my wife, she would be able to tell you the exact day and date. But I think it was maybe 1982. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be the last to know.
You probably don't remember this, but were there any like close contenders for like when you were thinking of what am I going to call this? Was like Google Punk on the list? Or Goggle Punk. That's what I mean.
Goggle Punk.
Was that on the list anywhere? Or you know?
No. Goggles weren't as big then as they've become. Now okay. they become the de rigueur part of a fetching steampunk. Ensemble. So no, not Goggle Punk. In some ways, I might have thought of maybe Clock Punk or Clockwork Punk. But that really didn't work. Now steampunk was just one of those fortuitous things where it makes me look a lot smarter than I really am.
Clockpunk? That could have worked.
Clockpunk, no, I think that sucks. steampunk is where it's at. And like I said, it makes me look a lot smarter and more prescient than I really am.
Wow. So I filmed that panel with my camera and provided that I make it home safely to Arizona and I'm able to transfer it safely from my camera to my computer and upload it to YouTube. That will be on YouTube. And
super.
Yeah, and I'm going to put that on my blog, sciencefictionfantasy.net. Hopefully we'll get it on our podcast's blog also, site and blog, which is adventuresinscifipublishing.com in the video section. But it was really like, you know, I just felt like that was incredibly cool to preserve that moment of you guys talking about the origins of what you were doing back then, being punky. And it was a hilarious panel, actually. So people you're a hilarious guy, if I do say so. And so people should check it out, I think, because it was really a lot of fun. You guys just joked the whole time.
Yeah. I hope people enjoy it because we had a lot of fun doing it. I hadn't seen Tim Powers and Jim in many years, and it was great to sort of reconnect. And that was the way we used to sort of joke and horse around back in our college days when we were hanging out together. And it was amazing how quickly we sort of reconnected at that level, and we're telling the same stupid stories and laughing at the same stupid things that we used to laugh at.
And you joked about how having named steampunk hasn't exactly made you rich at the panel, or at least not that particular. You're not getting a royalty check whenever anyone uses the word steampunk.
Yeah.
But you're still writing, so I'd like you to tell our listeners some of the books you're writing and putting out now, and where they can find them.
Sure. I'm actually just finishing up the sequel to my original steampunk novel, Infernal Devices. The new book will be called Fiendish Schemes. It should be out from Tor in 2013. And like I said, it's the sequel to Infernal Devices. I'm also have another book, should be coming out from St. Martin's next year, called Grim City, which is kind of a collaboration between me and a fellow in Germany who came across some really neat, previously untranslated Grimm's fairy tales, and we sort of riffed off that. It's not a fairy tale kind of book. It's more of an urban fantasy, very violent, which, was fun. And then I've been doing a lot of digital originals, e-publishing things. I just started a new thriller series revolving around a character named Kim O. First name Kim, K-I-M, last name O, O-H. She's a young Korean-American girl who kind of gets into becoming a freelance hitman. They're kind of funny, but also very action-packed, and they're available only as e-books. So you have to go on to either Kindle or Amazon for the Kindle or Barnes & Noble for the Nook and look for the first one. It's called Kim O, Real Dangerous Girl. And then the first three books are already up. It's going to be a continuing series, and I'm very, very, I'm loving writing these books. In some ways, these are more of my punk rock books than anything else. These are sort of my three-chord, raw, ragged, crazy, a lot of excitement to them type books. And so more than anything else, I hope people will check out the Kim O, Real Dangerous Girl.
Well, and we were just chatting about these books over at a table here, and you had a lot of enthusiasm for that when you were talking about it. You were talking about various things about releasing them independently, and the freedom and the excitement and the enthusiasm you had for that, and just how much fun it is. So I bet those are fantastic.
There's a revolution going on right now. Writers have an ability to connect directly with their readers in a way that we have never had before. We have a freedom now to write exactly the books that we want to write and get them out to our readers, and the readers can get them easier and or more easily and more inexpensively than ever before. And it's tremendous. It's very, what I'm telling people is that we are privileged to be at the start of the golden age of popular fiction. The golden age of popular fiction is actually starting now. Wow. With our ability through e-books and independent e-publishing, we are connecting with our readers and writing books that we never had the freedom to do before, and being able to be wild and crazy and put it out there and see if it hits its mark or not in a way that we, like I said, we weren't able to do before. There's a real revolution going on.
Wow. Last thing, you're headed to Ecuador, I hear. What's going on there?
Oh, at some point, my wife and I may travel overseas and live in another country for a while. And we've heard great things about Latin America, and we've lived abroad before and always enjoyed it. And one of the great things about the electronic revolution is that you can do so much business over the internet. You're free to set up shop wherever you want to. And so that's giving us a lot of creative freedom also, that you can go and you can still have your writing career no matter where you go. And that's tremendously liberating too.
Great. I'm going to throw up a blog post on my blog, again, sciencefictionfantasy.net, and I want to tell people about you and about your book so they know about you, because, I'd like more people to know about what you're doing. You were a lot of fun at the panel, and you helped coin something that's become a really great thing that a lot of people enjoy. So I hope people listening will check you out and support you and what you're doing.
Super. I'm glad you're doing that. The revolution depends upon people hearing about the revolution. So the more we talk about it, but the crazy thing is that people are hearing about it, are finding these new books, and are really getting back to us about how exciting it is as readers to be able to have this material that they might not have ever had before. So I think it's one of those win-win situations that comes along very rarely in human history where everybody is benefiting from this. It's a tremendous, tremendous period in cultural history.
Wow, awesome. Well, thanks for your time.
Hey, it was a pleasure. Glad you enjoyed the panel, and thanks for everything.
Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more, and email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musicalley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.